On proposed ordinances, the first ordinance for public hearing today is ordinance 2013-18. The title is littering. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to talk to this ordinance? Seeing none, the public hearing on ordinance 2013-18 is closed. It moves us to a public hearing on ordinance 2013-19. Harbors, Ports Department, and Elected Advisory Board. Anybody in the audience like to talk to this ordinance? Seeing none, the public hearing on ordinance 2013-19 is closed. And we'll open the public hearing on 2013-20. That ordinance is Public Safety Departments and Elected Advisory Board. Any comments from the public on that? Seeing none, we'll move on to ordinance 2013-21. And that ordinance is Parks and Recreation Department and Elected Advisory Board. Is there any public comment on that? Okay, seeing none, the public hearing on those two ordinances, 2013-20 and 21, is closed. That brings us to item 6 on the agenda, visitors' views related to the agenda. Is there... Matt?
I don't do this very often, as you can imagine. Matt Lichtenstein, KFSK Radio. Well, I think you have an agenda item tonight that, as partly, I think, due to our request for a document, and I just wanted to speak to that briefly, which is, I'm sorry I don't have the letter, but the number on your agenda, but it's a request for the document, a memo regarding the medical center. And we had requested that document based on mainly that we feel it's a public document. And Assemblyman Hogue brought up the issue last time, and as we thought about it, we believe that it is a public document. I just wanted to get on the record that we questioned how that document is not public. And the other question is whether or not as you look at Alaska's open records laws, there's a number of exemptions for that where you can, you know, have documents that are not public. There is one in particular that talks about, I believe, finances, but it's fairly broad. And that's actually applies, the financial part actually applies to the executive session, which is the other question I would raise, which is I'm not sure how discussing whether this document is a public document, that discussion can be justified to have in an executive session as well. I think more care or clarity or specificity needs to be taken in explaining why that document is not public and why the discussion in executive session is required as to whether it's public or not. So those are two questions I'd raise, you know, before you get to that early on. I don't mean to belabor the point, but we just want to put that on the record that basically we have concerns, and I guess to be frank, we do object to that document without any more specificity about what the document is, why that's not a public document, the hospital memo or the memo regarding the hospital from the city attorney or the borough attorney, and then we also question whether you can actually have an executive session to discuss whether that document is public, have that in private session, and I think that needs more specificity when you make a motion for the executive session to clarify, you know, what standard does this meet under law to say that, yes, we can have this discussion in private. And those are the two concerns I wanted to raise, and I'll leave it at that unless anyone had any questions.
No, thank you.
Okay.
Is there any more visitors' views related to the agenda? Brian.
Okay, Eric. Mr. Mayor, Assembly Members, Brian Lynch, I'm the Executive Director of Petersburg Vessel Owners Association, here to address item 13G, and it seems like only last week I was here addressing it. This is a consideration to be a signatory on a letter to our federal representatives asking that the federal government take more action to ensure that downstream Alaska water quality and fisheries will not be adversely affected by industrial development in B.C. I think that description is very apt. This letter kind of dovetails with a letter to Member of Parliament Cullen in June of last year that you guys did send. And this is just as your description stated. seeking more of an active role of the U.S. government, particularly the State Department, in the actual Canadian permitting process, which currently we don't really have any effective voice in. However, so that being said, there's currently a work group that has been formed by the mining companies that does include the state of Alaska agencies, DNR, DEC, Fish and Game, but the state has not yet submitted detailed comments, but my understanding is they intend to sometime early this month. Just a couple of points. This letter is really not meant to be anti-mining, per se, but the risk of these sorts of mines are one way. The risk to the water quality and fisheries resources is great. There's absolutely no risk of fisheries being a detrimental factor in a mining project. Some people, you know, oftentimes will couch these sort of concerns as jobs versus fish, but for us, this is jobs versus jobs, and there's likely to be no U.S. jobs that come out of this. The harm, again, is all one way. And we're targeting over 60 different commercial, sport, fishery, tourist organizations, tribal organizations, conservation organizations, processors, and some individuals who operate and do business in Southeast Alaska to sign on to this letter, and that is what I'm asking from the Assembly today. I'm not actually asking for a specific signature, but just you're okay to add the borough of Petersburg onto this letter. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Lynch while he's here? Okay. Eric, you had a comment under this? Yeah. Views related to the agenda?
Yeah. My name is Eric Lee, and I'm here to talk about the proposed rate changes to the landfill salvage program. I go up to the landfill about three times each summer for this and that, the other thing. I'm not a big player in that scene, but I do have a big interest in recycling, and I think it's very important that we try to recycle things as much as we can here in Petersburg. And I think that the increase in rates for the daily use of the landfill there for salvage, I think that will be counterproductive from a financial standpoint. I think that $10 a day for one day to go up there and look for something you may or may not find will discourage a lot of people. Right now, $5 a day is affordable. You go up there, maybe you find something that you're looking for, maybe you don't, but it's worth going up there and looking for, and at the same time doing a public service of recycling something. But $10 a day, I think, actually will discourage people. And I think the rates were $5 for 2 days of recycling. For $10 for one day, that's a fourfold increase. And I think I think it's unnecessary. I don't think it will have much. Whatever could possibly be gained by that increase will be lost by the recycling that doesn't get done by people who who choose not to go up there. So I would request that the council consider keeping the daily rate at $5, or actually $5 per day rather than $5 per 2 days. I think that would encourage the very important activity of recycling in this town, and also it would probably wind up raising as much or more money for the city. So that's about all I had to say about that. It's just a suggestion. I think that I would ask the council and the mayor to consider. I think it would be a lot better solution to the problem, because recycling is so important in this day and age. We have to recycle. We owe it to our kids. We owe it to the future to encourage recycling in any way we can. So I think that if the rate is a little lower that's affordable, it will do that, and I think that would be a great thing to do, to keep it low enough where people can go up there and recycle and at the same time contribute to the community's coffers. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Any other visitors' views related to today's agenda? Okay, seeing none, that brings us to the next item. That's visitors' views unrelated to the agenda. Dave, would you please State your name and who you represent, please. Yourself, I'm sure. But
I'm representing myself.
I'm Dave Iselson. I've sat on this board before, a long time ago. I have a few guys who still come to me with problems they think that somebody should address to the city, and I say, come to the meeting. They can't come to these meetings when they're held at this time of the day because they're working. So I don't know when we changed it to day meetings, but you've left out a large part of the community that do work during the day. So if they have something they want to address to you guys, they're out there trying to make a buck so they can pay the taxes and all the other stuff. So that's all I really had to say.
Okay, thank you, David. That came about last December or January when the borough was formed to make it so people from the outlying area could come to town and participate in the meetings. But
I don't know what the answer is, but you've left a large group of people out of the system. And I'm an old has-been, but they still come and talk to me. So.
Well, I 100% agree with you on that, but that isn't what happened. So maybe we'll address it again, but thank you for your input.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, that brings us to board, commission, and committee reports. And today, the consent agenda, there's local approval of gaming permits for 2014. Gaming permits for 2014 have been filed by the following entities: Swainson's Vending for Sons of Norway, Keto's Cave and Viking Swim Club, Petersburg Little League, Banana Ice Classic, and Alaska State Elks Association. Due to confidential information placed on the permit applications, the applications are no longer made part of the assembly meeting packet. Anyone wishing to view the applications may do so at the city clerk's office. So I'll entertain a motion to approve today's gaming permits for 2014.
So move.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
It's been moved by Member Strand, seconded by Member Logadakis, to approve today's applications for 2014 gaming permits from the entities listed below. Any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Cindy?
Yes.
John Hoag?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
John Haberlick?
Yes.
And Nancy?
Yes.
Okay, maybe we'll go through a couple more of these, and then for 1:30 we can take a little break if anybody needs to freshen up or whatever. But report of other officers, review of fiscal year 2013 audit report. Christy Thiel, I don't know if I pronounced that right, senior manager of VDO, the borough's auditing firm. We'll call her on the phone here and get a summary of the borough's financial status. And these statements are available for public viewing at the borough's website.
This is Christy.
Hi, Christy. This is Petersburg.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Okay, Christy, this is Mayor Jensen. You have a report to give us today?
Yes. Can I go ahead and get started?
Yes, would you please?
Okay. Good afternoon. I am Christy Teal with BDO. And for those of you who have not heard of BDO before, Matumbica Trail merged with BDO effective in July. So although we have a new name, we, the Anchorage office, have worked with you, the city, well, now the borough, for several years. And the partner on the engagement, John Boss, he did retire this last year, but I have worked on this engagement for the past 5 years. So if you do have questions, feel free to go ahead and ask, and I will try and answer them for you. So one of the key questions I get is, what do we do in an audit? And we are hired to audit the financial statements and express an opinion as to whether they are materially correct. So we do apply a concept of materiality, and what that means is whether something is significant enough to influence the decisions of the users of the financial statements. So what what we do is we perform field work and test work, and a team of about five of us comes down on site, and we do testing and develop an understanding of the internal controls that the borough has in place in order to prevent or detect fraud or misstatement of the financial statements. And we perform our test work and get comfortable with the numbers, and then we assist with drafting the financial statements from the information provided by borough staff. And then at that point is when we come to our opinion. And we did send down a separate bound document called Audit Wrap-Up, and that provides a required list of information under auditing standards that we are required to disclose in regards to our audit. And I would encourage you to read it in its entirety, but I will give you the summary version here. And we issued a clean opinion. We proposed only a few adjusting journal entries in regards to our test work. We did not note any accounts or any uncorrected misstatements that were not corrected. We didn't identify any internal control issues that we would have to disclose to you. And we received, as always, excellent cooperation from Jody and borough staff. So we don't really have anything bad to report here. So that's good news. But I would encourage you to read that document if you get a chance. So I would like to go through the financials, and if you have those in front of you, if you flip to page 9, this is our independent auditor's report. And this is essentially what you're hiring us to do, is opine on the financial statements. And on page 10, the very first sentence, in our opinion, the financial statements referred to above present fairly in all material respects. And that essentially means that we have an unmodified or a clean opinion, no material concerns there. And over on page 13, this begins the management's discussion and analysis. And we do not audit this. We tie in the numbers to make sure that they correspond with the financial statements, but it answers a lot of good why and how questions during the year from management's perspective. So I would encourage you to read that also if you have time. On page 28, these are the government-wide financial statements. So this is all-encompassing, all of the funds and the related component units to the borough. And this year, there was a new standard in place, GASB Statement 61, so the Government Auditing Standards Board, came out with this new statement, which requires you to evaluate your component units or potential component units. So the financial statements look a little bit different this year with the addition of Petersburg Medical Center. So Jody and I believe we had consulted with the attorneys also in regards to the relationship with the borough. And based on that relationship and the accounting standard, we determined that the medical center should be included. So on page 28, the far right column, Petersburg Medical Center, it's presented there, and it is also presented on page 29. If you look in the far left-hand column, it's the last line down, Component Unit Medical Center. And this is the only place you see the medical center in the financial statement. So it's like a condensed set of financial statements for both the school district and the medical center. Another difference this year, due to a change in standards as well, net assets are no longer called net assets, so the equity is now called net position for the government-wide financial statements and the enterprise funds. And one of the questions I get often is, how is the borough doing, the borough or the city doing financially? Are they improving or deteriorating? Well, if you go over to page 29, the third row from the very bottom, change in net position, this is a good indicator of whether the financial position is improving or not. And so you can see under the governmental activities column a positive change of $3.6 million. Under the business type activities column, negative $1.5 million, but a combined overall positive change of $2.1 million. And if you flip over to page 30, this begins the fund level financial statements. And I won't go through every fund in detail, but just point out a couple of key things we noticed this year. On page 30, down towards the bottom under fund balances, the last item unassigned, the general fund has unassigned fund balance of $3.9 million. So unassigned basically means that there are no restrictions or constraints on the use of that fund balance. And that is up approximately $300,000 from the previous year, so we've been seeing the general fund position getting better over the last couple of years. And one of the other funds I'd like to take a look at, on page 34, these are the enterprise funds. And specifically, assisted living, this is the fifth column over from the left. And in previous years, assisted living had to borrow cash from the general fund. And so you would have seen in the liabilities section of the balance sheet, you would have seen a due to other funds. But this year, the assisted living ended with positive cash. So it was not borrowing from the general fund at the end of the year. And there was a transfer from the general fund over to assisted living this year, but we are seeing where the assisted living fund is doing better. It looks like the revenues and collections increased, which led to a better net position as of the end of the year. So that's a positive change there. And on page 40, we start the notes to the basic financial statements. These provide more detailed info, certain disclosure items that you won't see from the face of the financial statements. I won't go through that in detail either, but these are just more information that standard setters feel are important for the users of the financial statement. And if you go back towards the end of the financials, page 133 starts the single audit section. And really, page 141 is a good summary of our results of the single audit. So also in regards to our financial statement audit, when you expend more than $500,000 of federal or state financial assistance, you are subject to what is called a single audit. And so we are required to look at the borough's compliance with grant provisions for both federal and state money. And on page 141, to summarize the results, we had an unmodified or a clean opinion on the financials as well as the federal and state major programs that we tested. We did not note any internal controls over financial reporting or over grant programs for federal and state purposes. We did not note anything that we would be required to disclose, no material weaknesses noted, or anything like that. So overall, in a nutshell, a clean audit, and the borough appears to be doing better this year than last year even, and new standards in effect, but essentially very similar information provided in the financial statements. And I would like to thank Jody and all of the borough staff who helped make the audit happen. We come in and it's kind of a whirlwind. We have to ask a whole bunch of questions and interrupt the day-to-day work, but we received excellent cooperation from the borough staff, so thank you. And are there any questions?
Is there any questions by the assembly? No, it seems like everybody is satisfied with your presentation and definitely with the finance department's work.
So, okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for your report, Christy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now we have a presentation of the 2013 Power and Light Revenue Requirements Study. Power and Light Superintendent Joe Nelson and Consultant John Heberling of D.H. Hittle Associates Incorporated will explain the study results and answer questions of the assembly. Okay, Joe.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
Can we entertain a break now? This may take a while.
Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. Is that enough?
Not by me. Thank you.
Okay, we'll reconvene at 1:25.
Based on the fact that we had consistently not recovered our costs with our revenues. 2010, for instance, we were negative $250,000. 2011, $109,000. 2012, it showed $390,000. I noticed that was restated, but at any rate, it was long enough time that we could see that this was a trend, not just a anomaly, that it was a trend. And so we went to work with D. Hittle and Associates to do this study. In addition to that, we recognized the fact that our declining block rates were set up originally some 25 years ago to encourage usage. And the last block on our residential rate, for instance, at 7 cents, is just 0.2 cents more than what we pay for it. We pay 6.8. So it was basically a pass-through to encourage people to use power. Those good old days are coming to an end. We need to take a look at making very wise use of the energy that we do have. The old hydro that we have available to us is a precious commodity. We need to treat it that way. We're also probably the only utility in Southeast that still has a declining block. Most others have gone to a flat rate, or in some cases like Sitka, who is in some deep water, they've gone to an inverted rate where they penalize high users. So with that introduction, you saw my memo. I'd like to get John up here to speak to you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Heberling. I'm an engineering consultant with D. Hittle & Associates, and we've been retained by Petersburg Municipal Light and Power to review a number of things related to revenue requirements and electric rates. We've got a few slides that we've put together here, and in lieu of actually putting these out on a PowerPoint projection, which wouldn't work today because of all of the sunshine on the screen, we've just got these in slides here that we can look at. So briefly, what I want to do is go through the analysis we conducted and then summarize with the proposed results. As you're aware, and as Joe indicated, we're viewing that the electric rates are insufficient right now to recover the necessary revenue requirement that you do have. So bottom line is we're going to be looking at a little bit of an increase in the process. We started this process a little over a year ago and have been working with Petersburg Municipal Light and Power for a number of years. I personally have been involved with you folks for going way back. And our firm has done some other work for Municipal Power and Light. We mostly do focus on working with consumer-owned utilities like your own. That makes things a little bit different than for investor-owned utilities. In your case, you're essentially operating a non-profit basis. So the revenue requirement projections involved putting together pro forma projection of revenues and expenses over the next 5 years. We've also looked at the cost of service that is involved with the electric utility. Cost of service is a process to go through and allocate costs to each customer class. We evaluated the rates and then came up with some alternative rate concepts. If you turn to page 3 in these slides, just to summarize real quickly the revenue requirements, you'll notice the chart at the bottom of the page indicates that the expenses, these are kind of based on current levels of expenses. Power purchases, which are your purchases from SEPA, represent 55% of your overall revenue requirement. That's actually fairly typical for electric utilities to have roughly half of their total cost tied to electric power purchases or production. In your case, it's a little bit more, meaning that the rest of your operations are probably a little bit more efficient than they would be otherwise. As you can see, the other expenses that are in here are distribution, operation, and maintenance. There's some administrative and general expenses, debt service, which is the payment of principal and interest on debt, and then a capital budget, which is relatively small as we go forward. You've come off of a relatively capital-intensive period of time here where there's been some upgrades made to the electric system. And as we're looking forward into the future, we don't see that same level of expense, at least in the next few years. So the revenue requirements that show up on page 4 indicate the chart at the top that we're looking to be a little bit on the low side in 2014, about 3.4%. 3.8% in 2015, and assuming that expenses go up with inflation or something approximately that nature in the future, we're seeing increases in the future. This is cumulative on the bottom, so 5% over where you're at now by the time you're in 2016 and 6.2% in 2017. Cost of service analysis is an analytical process where you define revenue requirements and billing determinants and determine allocation factors and then allocate the costs of the electric utility operation out to the various utility classes or the customer classes that you're doing or that you currently have. And those are currently the residential, harbor, small commercial, and large commercial. We go through the process of developing allocation factors based on a number of things. One of them that shows up on page 6 on the bottom is another pie chart there that shows as far as the use of energy within the Petersburg system, large commercial customers use 41.6% of the overall energy, residential about 40%. Small commercial 14.2 and harbor 3.5. So this is what you would use to allocate the cost of purchase power from SEPA since it's purchased on an energy basis. So 41.6% of the SEPA cost goes to large commercial customers is what that's telling us. Yeah?
I just was looking at your pie chart.
Mm-hmm.
So these figuring out these allocation factors is what that 5% allocation cost is referring to. Is that correct?
5%.
I'm just trying to understand what that allocation factor figure is.
Well, the allocation factors are essentially the portion of identifiable product that the electric utility is providing that is used by the various customer classes. So, yeah, when we're talking about how much energy you produce, 41.6% of that goes to large commercial customers. Okay. They're using 41.6% of the overall energy.
Right. But you've got a 5% allocation factor that's different than an admin figure, and I'm trying to figure out what the difference is between those two.
Okay. And are we looking, where's the 5% you're referring to?
It is back on, it was that pie chart that you first
page 3.
On page 3.
Oh, allocated expenses?
Yeah, that's trying to understand different. What that is.
Yeah, those are actually borough expenses that are of a general nature, you know, the administration and so forth of the borough, motor pool and so forth, that get reassigned out to Municipal Power and Light.
Okay, thank you.
That's a different allocation, but
yeah.
I'm glad you caught that term, allocated. It shows up in both places. So we go through the process of allocating these costs based on two primary principles, that energy-related costs are allocated out based on how much energy you use as a customer class, and other costs are a little more fixed, set up more on how the system is built and what it's built for. It's built to provide the peak capacity of each individual customer class. So we allocate distribution expenses and so forth based on that. The cost of service results is shown on page 7. Indicate that residential customers are paying a little under their cost of service, and commercial customers are paying a little over, but pretty much close right there. I mean, you've got a system that's fairly well in balance. In looking at this, what you might interpret it as saying is that residential rates probably should go up a little more than commercial rates as you're going forward.
Do you factor in the demand issue when it comes to large commercial when you go to do this? Because, for example, while large commercial might be using 40% of the energy,
mm-hmm.
they may be demanding it at peak times that cost us more money because of our having to have the infrastructure there to support it.
Yes.
I mean, is that factored into this?
That is factored in. Okay. And actually, if you go back to page 6, that chart at the top of that page where you see average coincident peak, that's talking about how much capacity is needed at any one point in time when everyone's all wanting it. In that case, large commercial is looking at it close to 50% of the overall system.
Because I'm assuming we're not able to really track our costs directly to large commercial versus residential. We're just using the allocation factor.
That's right.
Okay. So,
we look at large commercial and say that 50% of the system components that were built to supply peak demand are being allocated that way at 50% then. So one other thing just to look at here on the bottom of page 7 is that the bars on that chart are indicating that residential, the cost of service based on 2013 costs, which we used in this study, should be up at about 10.46 cents if fully allocated, as opposed to 9.67 where they're at. As I mentioned, the commercial looks to be fairly well in balance the way it's at. Now, following the cost of service analysis, we move into the rate evaluation component of this, and this is where we're looking at what the existing rates will accrue as far as revenue and where they possibly should go. Your current rates right now, as you can see on the tables on page 8, $9 a month for a customer charge. And there is, as Joe mentioned, a declining block in energy. There's three energy blocks for residential customers, starting at 11.8, going to 11.4, and then down to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. So any kilowatt hours or 650 kilowatt hours are charged at 7 cents a kilowatt hour. It's a very good, very low rate, actually. You don't see that in too many places, even outside Alaska. Commercial rates, all the rate classes are using these three energy blocks. And they are all declining. And they get pretty low. So what we're looking at And I'm just going to kind of skip through some of this because if we want to go back and ask questions, we can. But looking at the objectives on page 10, that's the bottom slide on page 10, we were looking to try and phase in any kind of adjustment over a two-year period in order to minimize any impact on businesses and residences. We wanted to simplify the number of energy blocks down to 2 from 3. And we wanted to, for the most part, increase the last or the highest, the second energy block in this case, in order to start to send a price signal that would say that as we look forward into the future, it's going to cost more to generate more power, to build new generators and so forth to provide that next block of power. So it's kind of a slight shift to move that up. There are a few other things, for instance, with commercial, dealing with some transition points going from small to large commercial. We wanted to leave the monthly customer charge where it's been. The customer charge can move around. You can allocate costs differently that way, as well as demand charges can be moved around. But the customer charge is something that's actually very sensitive. Most residential customers prefer not to have much change to that. And we wanted these rates to move a little closer towards cost of service if possible. But what we've got now, as you look on page 11, is this proposed concept of 2 energy blocks. And we'll just focus on residential to begin with. Instead of being 0 to 325 kilowatt hours for the first block, it's now 0 to 500. And the rate is set to be pretty much where it was. So anybody in any small consumers will not see any impact at all to speak of with this proposed adjustment. We want these rates to actually produce about 2% increase the first year and another 2% the second year is the objective in this. So as you look at page 12, projected revenue increases. Overall, at the bottom, from year 2, overall we're looking at about a 4% increase. Residential customers are going to go up on average 4.4. Harbor customers, 4.3. General service, we're renaming this small commercial class to general service. And then large commercial would go up about 3.5% on average. And this doesn't mean that everybody within each of these rate classes goes up 3.5%. It will change because of the way that these energy blocks are being moved around. But for the average residential consumer at about 1,000 kilowatt hours a month, the increase is 10 cents for a monthly bill. And that was one of the objectives in this, too, is to try and keep the impact on small-end consumers very low. Larger residential consumers will see more of an impact. And that's where we start to make that shift, that second energy block is moving up. And you can see on those proposed rates that it's going from 7 cents up to 7.8 cents in the first year, and then probably and up to 8.1 cents at the end of second year. So it's a noticeable change there. So with that, I think I'll open it up to questions, if anyone has any specific questions they'd like to ask.
Any questions of Mr. Lieberman?
I just had sort of comment question. So my understanding of this is that we'll the system rebuild to be funded from current revenue? in any rebuild of the system is funded from current revenue and reserves. So any increase in cost is going to cover power generation. It's not going to fund any future capital improvement. Is that correct?
Looking forward, yes. We have all of the capital improvement or replacement, renewals, replacements, replenishments, whatever that might be involved in the future. At this point, it's pretty much all going to come from the current revenues. There's no assumption in here of any new debt or any borrowings of any type.
Wish prayer, if I may.
If I could just add that, like you mentioned, we've had some fairly major projects. The conversion of the old 2400-volt system that we accelerated, we borrowed money to do that. And then the addition of the generator at Scow Bay, we borrowed money to do that. Looking forward, we try to levelize the capital expenditure each year just to maintain our system. And so we're not seeing, at least in the term of the study, the 5-year, we're not seeing anything, big bumps in that.
One of my concerns with the electrical system in particular is Joe doesn't have the luxury of state legislative grants or DEC low interest loans and grants. Electric systems tend to be self-funded. I mean, even at these rate increases, it appears we're still not covering depreciation.
And that's a good point. Yes. When we look at your cash obligations, depreciation is not included in there. But some of the items that depreciation will usually fund, such as the capital budget and the amortization of debt, is acknowledged as a cash obligation. So you'll probably still tend to see when depreciation is added in that you're not collecting a full amount to fund that full depreciation allowance. But unless you've got some expenditures coming up, the only place that depreciation would go would just be into some kind of reserve at this point, you know, for future replenishment of the system.
John?
And I guess this would be more of a question for you, Joe. I know we're pretty well maxed out on our usage now. Is there any capital project that could go on in the community or you know, improvement of generators or generator Cabin Creek or improvement of the Crystal Lake generator that would produce, help us get more electricity that we would need to fund?
Well, first of all, our system still has some room on it. If we're talking about our distribution system, we still have some room on it. We don't have we're not approaching an overload condition on our existing lines, for instance. Since we built that new line in behind the airport and split our load up, we're still in very good shape that way. Our substation transformer, the main transformer, is fine. Now that we have the new generator at Scow Bay, we have enough diesel generation to back up the system should we lose Tyee. So in the immediate future, by that I mean the next 5 years, we don't see any need to increase the capacity of our system. It's well able to handle what we've got now. Plus, we're still seeing conversions to electric heat kind of by default. People are going in and buying portable heaters and things like that and plugging them in. I noticed this morning when I checked the load, we have the generator at Vine Slough at 1 meg right now. And when I looked at how much was delivered here in town, it was zero. It was all being used before it got to town. Now that's an increase of almost... It's almost 100% increase over since 4 years ago. So there's lots of folks out there that have got heaters and are not going out to the wood pile. Did that answer your question?
Basically, we've got what we need.
We do have. What we need to concentrate on now is that we've got a fairly old pole system. We've got a lot of poles out there that are beginning to grow ferns and small trees out the top of them. And those poles need to be replaced. So we're looking at a comprehensive pole change-out program over the next a few years.
Yeah. But for generation, we have plenty.
We do.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, yeah, I've got
Mr. Hope?
Yeah, I've got a few. Do you want? Do you have some?
No. Go ahead.
Looking at page 5 of your study, you talk about the SEPA rebate.
Mm-hmm.
How many years now has the utility received the SEPA rebate?
Yeah, I think it's been three out of the last. Excuse me. I think it's been three out of the last four.
Is it reasonable to project that you just can't count on it in the future, or should it be budgeted?
I switch and put my SEPA board hat on, I would say don't count on it. It may be there and it may not be there. We're looking at basically the second year of water shortage, of dry year, and so I'm anticipating that the SEPA revenues are going to be down again this year. Last year we were still able to process a rebate. It was smaller than the previous year, but this coming year, then switching hats again back to the power superintendent, I don't know how you budget for that, because it's indeterminate. It's based on the performance, the overall performance of SEPA.
And there are those that would say that you should be an advisor as opposed to part of the SEPA board. Okay. I do have some more questions, if I may, on this. Okay, on table 3, or A 3.1, of which is all I can say is it's towards the back.
Yes.
You've got land, Mitkoff Highway plant relocation, $630,000. That is money reserved for the purchase of land, or has land been purchased? Joe, maybe you can help on this one. Top figure.
Sue, help me out here.
I'm not seeing it. Is it page 2 of 2?
No, it's page 1 of 2.
Page 1 of 2.
At the top.
That's probably the capital project of when we built the, changed everything, moved everything out to the coal yard.
There's no land purchase in this, no. This is part of the ongoing project to move out the road to the property that was previously purchased.
All right, so this is a expenditure based on a projection of moving?
Well, this is actually an asset here.
Yeah.
Okay, this is an asset.
Right.
The land is an asset.
Yes.
That's what it's reflected as. Okay.
We bought the other property too, the lower part and the upper part, but it didn't amount to this amount. So, I can't remember the amount on what our purchase price was.
It looks confusing to me, because down at the bottom of that section you got clearing lands and ROW of $77,000. Now, is that an asset?
Well, right of way, yeah, it would be an asset.
All right, so this is the value of right of way land that's been purchased?
That's the way it would be interpreted. Yeah. Or is owned.
And if the borough was to reverse what I understand was a direction given years and years ago and say there's no reason to relocate anything more than has been relocated to save money, then that would free up these assets, potentially, for the use by the utility.
Not really. We have built the metal building.
Okay, is that the land that with the building on it today?
Generators.
Okay, all right. The depreciation that is listed is, you said, depreciation allowance.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen two types of depreciation. One that Uncle Sam lets us take if we're running a business for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And two, what I would call a realistic depreciation, which is the functional life of whatever we're using. What do we have here?
We are looking here at the the accounting form of it,
That's Uncle Sam's form, correct, we're talking about?
Yeah, more or less.
So this does not reflect the realistic depreciation of the life of these items.
Well, it's, yeah, we didn't go through and actually evaluate depreciation here. But it's probably close, I would think. You know, most utility plant, we look to, electric utility plant, we look to last about 40 years, depreciate over 40 to 50 years. 30 to 50 years is the way it kind of works. So, yeah, we weren't actually looking at the depreciation, but it should be more Uncle Sam's approach, I think, is what you're looking at.
The other question is that the beginning cash balance this year was $6.1 million. Would have been a lot more if there hadn't been a certain construction project that had gone on. The question is, what for this fund, for the realistic risks in use, is an appropriate cash balance?
It's a good question. I did not look at that this time around. In previous studies, actually going back several years, we did take a closer look at what that would realistically be recommended to be. But I can't tell you right now what it should be.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because there was an issue of some of this cash balance may have been reflected saving money for a potential move. It's probably not going to happen. Of your whole shop, Joe. So I'm curious as to whether if the cash balance is in excess of what is really needed for day-to-day operations, then the question is other than to look at this inverted allocation, is raising rates necessary?
The bottom reserve amount as determined in 2005 by vehicle was $2.5 million in 2005 dollars. I think today that would be closer to $3 million probably. So if you take that $3 million bottom and add to it present obligations that we have to pay for contracts that have already been signed and that sort of thing, that you'll come up with a number that's not too different from what the balance is. In other words, there's not a lot of money that you could draw out of there because we are not making that move out the road.
Where in either the budget or this is the obligations that would add up to another $3 million?
It's an exercise that Jody would have to go through and look at the present balance of obligated funds. We still have some money due McGraw. Well, no, we finally processed that last payment, but we still have some money due Marsh Creek, for instance, for the generator. And I don't have those figures.
I just wanted to chime in one thing. At the end of 2012 fiscal year, that's in here, the Power and Light had a considerable amount of bond revenue left to spend on their projects, which that money, which you still have some bond revenue left, remaining, I'd probably say at the end of June 30th, I think it was about $600,000, is in those numbers probably in your reserves. So, and that has to be spent on your capital projects.
What
for the voters?
And you could give us, if you consider a rate increase, you could give us a more detailed analysis of that.
Sure.
The next question is there any chance with either of your hats, Joe, of any kind of low interest loan programs for either business or commercial or residential to encourage weatherization and conservation?
The borough manager has very much encouraged me to get involved in demand side issues, conservation. And at this point, rather than get into the banking industry, we've chosen to back the air source heat pumps, and so we are making a rebate available for air source heat pumps, and they are turning out to be quite popular. There's a lot of them being installed. There will be more installed if they can get a rebate. That's not to say that isn't something we could do. certainly something we could look at, but there are state programs, a number of state programs that do this very thing. So I'm not sure if it'd be a good an option, but we could certainly consider it.
And you could certainly educate us on what state programs are available for residents of this community to do weatherization.
Yes, we could.
Okay, thank you. That's all the questions I have, Mr. Mayor.
Anyone else with questions of Joe or John? Okay, seeing none, thanks for your presentation. Okay, that brings us to the mayor's report. And first item there is the appointment of a deputy mayor. The retirement of Sue Flint from the assembly has created a vacancy in the deputy mayor position. Without any objection by the assembly, I would like to appoint member Cindy Logadakis to the mayor pro tem position. Do you still think it's a good idea, Cindy?
Sure.
Okay. Any objections by any other members? Seeing none, Cindy is appointed in the vice mayor position. Work session reminder, Thursday, December 5th at 9 a.m., the Assembly and Hospital Board will conduct a work session. Items to be discussed are finances, budgeting, and development of municipal code provisions for the board. I will not be able to attend that meeting, so I will have to hear from other assembly members what takes place. Land sale reminder, the borough will be auctioning off four real property lots at the December 16th, 2013 meeting. The lots are located on the undeveloped portion of Valkyrie Street. The minimum acceptable purchase price is $6,000 for each lot. Further information on the land sale is available at the clerk's office. Due to the timing of our meetings being so close together, last week we had a meeting. The manager has not compiled a report. Unfinished business. Ordinance for third and final reading. Ordinance 2013-17, an ordinance providing for Chapter 14.12, entitled Sanitation of the Municipal Code, updating current language to reflect borough incorporation and providing incentive for recycling. This is a third and final reading. I would also add to this, the ordinance has been revised by Attorney Heidemann since its second reading in Section 14.12-.210, fines for violations are to be as provided in Chapter 1.16, Proposed Ordinance 2013-22, provides for a fine schedule for the code. So I would entertain a motion to adopt 2013-17 in the third and final reading.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved by Member Strand, seconded by Member Haverlick to adopt 2013-17 and its third and final reading. Any discussion? Mr. Hogue.
Mr. Mayor, listening to testimony at the last session and this session, I guess I may have a question for Carl. Is there a way to reflect in the rates that you charge for recycling to encourage people going up and getting spare parts, in essence, what they need for, say, a refrigerator, a freezer, a broken item, versus people going up there and salvaging scrap that the borough could be putting in its own revenue stream?
Mr. Mayor, that question has been the hardest to answer with this. That's what we're trying to address with the proposed ordinance. It's very difficult to differentiate between customers as they come through the gate and go in the landfill. Somebody, if we set up a system where commercial salvagers were categorized in one area and received certain rates for doing their activities, and the small operator that just wants a part off a washing machine in another category, how do we police that? Because everybody's going to want to pay the least amount for a permit. Once they get through the gate, if they come out with a control knob off a washing machine, hooray. If they come out with a pickup load full of copper, how do we deal with that? So it's very difficult. It's not an easy question to answer as far as setting up the program and differentiating between customers.
Mr. Hogue.
Has there been consideration of simply putting the valuable items that is going to bring in money to the borough off limits for recycling?
We've thought about that. We have. It turns into a higher effort in policing the program. It's something that we could do, and it's something that can be done without really any need for that to be in the ordinance. It's not in the ordinance now, so that can be an administrative action taken after the fact, but that could be something.
Thank you.
I would just, my opinion, just seeing that there's been a change in addition since the second reading, I would consider that we have to go back and have that start again. So if it's a big enough change, and I read through it, but I didn't get the, you know, clarification of the fine amount, but I didn't obviously read it into that much depth. But
could we ask the clerk her opinion on that, Mr. Mayor?
What's that?
Ask the clerk if we need to go back for a first reading.
If we change an ordinance after the public hearing, is it prudent to have a public hearing again?
It's actually going to be at your pleasure. You do not have to. It's not required to, but if you feel you should, then you should.
I just believe in being as open as we can and giving people a chance to comment. And to say that we can take away the recycling effort that is taking place in the dump without it being in the ordinance, maybe we can, but I know there's going to be some ruffled feathers if they can't comment on a public hearing on that as well. Just trying to...
Mr. Mayor, can I just...
Yes.
I personally look at what was proposed by your attorney is not something of major effect that needs to have a public hearing, but if you're planning on changing the salvaging program as it's understood, then I can understand what you're thinking about having on the hearing. What your attorney's proposed for you as a change is pretty minor. It's just
okay.
Administrative.
Okay, thank you. Carl, do you want to make another comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. The changes that are made, as Kathy said, basically it's setting up a fine schedule dealing with violations of the code, which is going to happen for every code, and that that process is not a big change as far as the operational aspects of the code as presented in the last reading. If there's a will of the assembly to change the salvage program and get away from the commercial nature of it, it would be great to receive a consensus, because that obviously that's the direction the department is going. If I knew for certain that the assembly was supportive of that move, then we as a department could make changes that would go down that road.
It seems to me that it should have been more presented to us in a clear that is the direction that, you know, the department might want to go.
Well, if I may, I think it was Eric that mentioned it, I guess he was looking at it from a standpoint that we were stopping recycling. Am I correct, Carl, in that that material is still being recycled? It's just a matter of who's recycling it rather than, I mean, I'm not sure Eric understood the process in the standpoint. Just because we're not allowing, you know, Steve to come down there and get it doesn't mean that the borough isn't sending that stuff off to the recycling provider. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
All of the material in that pile will be recycled.
That's what I thought. I mean, the big question is back to kind of that issue of, is the purpose of allowing people up to the landfill to get a spare part that they need, or is it to promote this secondary line of business for people who go up there, recycle the scrap for a profit, therefore lowering the borough's take, if you want to call it, on that stuff? And that becomes the question. I mean, do we administratively or operationally want Carl's folks to manage a process that benefits, you know, people going up there and looking for copper, and we just pay for that? Or do we want to have a system that just says, okay, we've got a permit that you can go up there and look for a part for your washing machine, but it's not designed for commercial salvaging?
I think if didn't Carl make a statement that that's what this was put in place for originally, was for people to be able to go up and, I've used it to go up and get a piece for my old car that I have off island for hunting, and it was very beneficial. I've only been up there 2-3 times and paid my $5 or whatever it was. So I think we need to be careful if we all of a sudden pass this ordinance and then people aren't allowed in there to do what they have been doing in the past. Mr. Hogue?
I suggest that we can pass this ordinance because it doesn't affect the big issue of do we allow commercial recycling that'll reduce, in essence, the revenue the borough gets. And I would suggest we could put it on the agenda, Mr. Mayor, and have hearings on that issue and listen to the commercial people. And because if Carl can administratively says, all right, we know these things, copper, aluminum, these items have value, we're simply not going to allow them to be recycled because that's a loss of revenue to the borough. I mean, hypothetically, we should be maximizing the borough's revenue. On the other hand, if we're hurting existing businesses that employ people, there's an offset there.
Yeah, I don't know how much it would be employees, but definitely individuals have been using it and getting...
Well, then I think in deference to them that we could go ahead and have the third reading, vote on this today, and then bring it back as a discussion item, as you know, on the agenda as to whether, and just simply to say if anything's got value that's going to bring revenue to the borough, it's not going to be available for commercial recycling or any recycling by individuals.
So before the administration would make that decision, it needs to come before a public...
It may not need to, but I think that would be good government.
I think it would be prudent.
Yes.
I mean, that's probably the only way I would vote for this again today in the third reading is if something like that happened before the administration decided you can't go up there and collect things you've been used to. I mean, how many years has that been going on? 2-3 years, Carl? I mean, it's been a while.
Oh, no, yeah. It's been in place for almost 10 years, I think.
Oh,
the program itself has been.
Yeah, I think the realization of what people can drag out of there, though, and turn a buck on is grown.
It's gotten bigger and bigger, yes.
Yeah, so.
And if I may, that's primarily, I think, due to the rising cost of metals.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
It's a problem down south. People steal copper off of line trucks and such because of the value of it.
Yeah, take off existing equipment.
So is there any more discussion on ordinance 2013-17?
18. Oh, 17, I'm sorry.
It is 17. It's 17. Well, seeing none, will the clerk...
Can I ask a question or pass on some information? Your future member, assembly member, Mr. Lynn, did make comments to this and asked that I bring them up. It was a minor thing, and it is an oversight on our part. Sanitation is not supposed to be open burning part. He has concern about that. It was not supposed to be applied to the outside, and he wanted it amended in the ordinance you're considering now. However, Sarah said, our attorney, that is more appropriate to be addressed in 9.24, and she's recommending we just add an extra section to this ordinance that says subsection 1205B shall not be applied outside of service area 1, except into accordance with a borough open burning ordinance subsequently adopted by the assembly. I don't know if Bob knows that we're adopting these ordinances as we get to them, and they affect other things that we have to look at, and that's what he was concerned about. Don't say we can't burn outside current city limits or what used to be city limits. And this was Sarah's way of relaxing this. I'm having a hard time explaining it. The no burning, which this ordinance that you're looking at in section 1412.05B says they have to have a permit to do any open burning. When the charter was developed and we were promoting the charter, we said we're not going to enforce any no burning laws on outside. So to correct this, and not to correct it, the true place that this no burning has to be taken care of is in Chapter 9.24, a different title. And that's where she wants you to address it. When we get around to amending 9.24, we'll address it then. In the meantime, to assure the people outside that we're not going to enforce this no burning, she wants this subsection added that I had just read, that it does not apply to outside until at one point in time we address it in 9.24.
So she's suggesting that we add under 14.12050B as a subsection to B?
It's just going to be a subsection to your ordinance, that thing that you're adopting right here now is not going to apply to the outside, that no burning is going to be taken up when we look at Chapter 9.24.
Currently, Carl, burn barrels are still allowed, aren't they, without calling in and getting a permit?
Yes, I believe so. That activity is covered by the fire department, and I believe that is an approved activity. burn barrels are.
That's
for.
They have rules to follow as well.
Yes.
They do not have to call out and apply for a burn permit. And they're free.
So if anybody on the assembly feels we need to amend this section, we need a motion to do so.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
As I understand it, the attorney's recommendation is don't amend 14, 12, but to amend in Chapter 9 when we get to it.
Of the charter.
Right. Yes.
And to
of the code.
And
of
yeah,
the code,
and yeah. To let them assurances that that is what we're going to do. She wants us to add a subsection to the ordinance we're adopting, but it's not affecting the code. It's just the, like where you have the effective date of the ordinance. We say it takes effect on a certain date. She also wants it in there that we are not putting this on the outside. It's only on service area 1 until we hit 9.24.
So this amendment would be on page 15 of 15, section 5.
You put it right in there, yeah.
And you would add a sentence saying
1412.05b shall not be applied outside of service area 1 except in accordance with the borough open burning ordinance subsequently adopted by the assembly.
All right, Mr. Mayor, I move that we amend section 5 of the ordinance to add those exact words at the last sentence.
Is there a second?
I will second.
It's been seconded by Member Lagadakis. So any discussion on that amendment?
No.
Will the clerk call the roll on the amendment?
Nancy.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
John Ho.
Yes.
And John Haverlett.
Yes.
Okay, the amendment to Ordinance 2013-17 is passed. Now we need to vote on the ordinance as amended. Any discussion on that before we vote? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
John Haverlett.
Yes.
John Hogue.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes.
And Nancy.
Yes.
Okay, it passes 5-0. Okay, ordinances for second reading. Ordinance 2013-18, an ordinance providing for Chapter 9.12 entitled Littering of the Municipal Code, updating current language to reflect borough incorporation. This is the second reading. I'd entertain a motion to adopt this in its second reading.
So move.
Second.
Moved by Member Haverlick, seconded by Member Strand to adopt Ordinance 2013-18 in the second reading. Any discussion? Kathy.
And this is the other one that Mr. Lynn had some concerns with that Sarah has addressed. He felt that the one section that prohibits postings on like posts and all that would prohibit our posting of our notices on signs. So if Sarah is recommending an addition to that, that and you'll see it in the, we can put it in the third reading so you have it there, just maybe so you know what's coming there. We're going to retain that language, but it's going to be done administratively, and I can read what she's got proposed. No person shall post or affix any notice, post, or any other device calculated to attract the attention of the public to any lamppost, public utility pole, traffic, parking, or street sign, or control device, or shade tree, plant, or planter located in a public place or upon any public structure or building, except as may be authorized or required by law or as designated by a borough official. That would leave it, she's looking at that, that would leave it up to like the harbor department, the harbor master to say, yeah, you can continue to put your postings on the rampways. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can post on our bulletin board. We're sticking out at tap keys. He was concerned that that language as originally proposed was prohibiting any postings, and so this was her remedy. And I just wanted you to know you're going to see that in the third and final reading added to it.
Okay, thanks for the heads up. Any other discussion? Will the clerk call the roll on 2013-18 in the second reading?
Mark.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
John Haverlick.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
And John Hope.
Yes.
Okay, the next ordinance in the second reading is Ordinance 2013-19, an ordinance providing for the Harbors and Ports Department and Advisory Board. This is the second reading. Entertain a motion to adopt this.
So move.
Second?
I'll second.
Motion's been made by Mr. Haverlick and seconded by Cindy Loganakis to approve ordinance 2013-19 in its second reading. Any discussion?
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
I will be voting against the next three ordinances because, first, I think the advisory board for Harbor should be appointed, and second, I don't think the other two boards that are in the next two ordinances should be in existence. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Any other comments on this ordinance, 2013-19? Will the clerk call the roll?
Nancy?
Yes.
Cindy?
Yes.
John Hogue?
No.
Mark?
Yes.
John Haverlick?
Yes.
Okay, ordinance 2013-19 passes its second reading with a 4-1 vote. Ordinance 2013-20, an ordinance providing for a borough health officer, fire department, police department, and retention of a five-member elected advisory board. That's the short title, second reading. In response to concerns voiced at the November 25th, 2013 assembly meeting that the ordinance automatically designated the chief of staff of the medical center to be the health officer, Attorney Heidemann has recommended that section 3.20.010 be amended to give the borough flexibility to acquire the most knowledgeable person for different needs. The proposed amendment provides for the borough manager to appoint a health officer for each specific need as it arises. So that's a change. It's been recommended. Entertain a motion to adopt 2013-20 in its second reading.
So move.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
I know it's been a long meeting, but motion made by Member Strand, seconded by Member Loganakis to adopt 2013-20 in its second reading. Any discussion? Do we need to make an amendment to?
No, it's already in there.
Okay, that's changed then. All right, so seeing no discussion, we will have the clerk call the roll.
Nancy?
Yes.
John Haverlick?
Yes.
John Hogue?
No.
Mark?
Yes.
Cindy?
Yes.
Okay, ordinance 2013-20 passes in its second reading. Next ordinance up for second reading is 2013-21, an ordinance providing for borough parks and recreation and retention of a five-person elected advisory board. I would entertain a motion to adopt this in its second reading.
I move we adopt ordinance 2013-21.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved by Member Loganakis, seconded by Member Strand to adopt ordinance 2013-21 at second reading. Any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Cindy?
Yes.
John Hogue?
No.
John Haverlick?
No.
Mark?
Yes.
Nancy?
Yes.
Okay, ordinance 2013-21 fails in its second reading and didn't get four votes. So, 3-2 vote, right, Kathy?
That's correct. Counted.
So is the ordinance dead then?
It is, unless you want to bring it back for another reading, you can do that. But then we'd have to get into some technicalities. Someone would have to change their vote.
Okay.
Because I don't think the two that voted against it are going to change their mind.
Probably not. I know that would have to work. Okay, well, no Parks and Recreation Board at this point. Okay, judo appeal of the Petersburg Borough boundaries. There's no new information. Still waiting for the Superior Court judge's decision. And the next issue in front of us is consideration to be a signatory on a letter to our federal representatives asking that the federal government take more action to ensure that downstream Alaska water quality and fisheries will not be adversely affected by industrial development in British Columbia. This is what Brian Lynch presented today. So I'd entertain a motion to let the borough be a signatory on this letter.
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, it's been moved by Member Haverlick, seconded by Member Hogue, to sign on this letter about rivers without borders, basically. Any more discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Cindy?
Yes.
John Hogue?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
John Haverlick?
Yes.
And Nancy?
Yes.
Okay, it passes 5-0. We will sign the letter. New business. Ordinance 2013-22, an ordinance providing for a fine schedule for the municipal code and including a section addressing injunctive and civil relief. This is the first reading. The ordinance establishes fine amounts for violations of provisions in Titles 4, 6, and 14. It also provides for a unified fine schedule for violations of the code as to facilitate enforcement and collection of such fines, and provides for injunctive and civil relief for code violations. Entertain a motion to pass 2013-22 in its first reading.
So move.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, it's been moved by Member Hogue, seconded by Member Lagadakis to adopt Ordinance 2013-22 in its first reading. Any discussion? The clerk, please call the roll.
Mark.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
John Haberlett.
Yes.
And John Hogue.
Yes.
Okay, Ordinance 2013-22 passes 5-0 in its first reading. The next thing on the agenda today is Resolution 2013-26, Fiscal Year 2014 Shared Fisheries Business Tax Program Alternative Method Resolution. I entertain a motion to adopt this resolution.
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
The motion been made by Member Havlicek, seconded by Member Hogue, to adopt Resolution 2013-26. Is there any discussion on this item? Will the clerk call the roll?
Nancy.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
John Hogue.
Yes.
John Havlicek.
Yes.
Okay, that moves us on to the next item, authorization to enter into a professional services agreement with P&D Engineers in the amount not to exceed $21,000 for engineering services for the permitting and design work of a new fish cleaning float at the South Harbor. The borough has received a Chinook Salmon Mitigation Infrastructure Grant in the amount of $225,800 for this project. I would entertain a motion to authorize this.
So move.
Second, anyone?
Second.
Moved by Member Havlicek, seconded by Member Hogue to authorize the borough to go into a professional services agreement with P&D not to exceed $21,000 to design the fish cleaning station. Maybe it'll help the sea lions go away.
Maybe.
Any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Mark?
Yes.
Nancy?
Yes.
John Havlicek?
Yes.
Cindy?
Yes.
John Hogue.
Yes.
Okay, the next item is authorization to enter into a professional services agreement with MRV Architects per their November 25th and 26th, 2013 proposal in the amount of $91,560 to provide the conceptual and schematic building design process for the police station and municipal building renovation project.